Good to be back with you tonight. I know that Sunday evenings, at least at home, can be a challenge to keep those who have eaten likely perhaps more than they normally do and maybe a little sleepy because of it. I thought about what to teach upon tonight, and I thought about what Jesus said. Take no thought in that hour for what you will say or what you will speak. Wouldn't that be nice? But I don't have that choice. So I had two lessons that I was trying to decide between, and I've decided upon this one. So we'll see if, I guess you'll never know what the other choice might have been unless you ask. But has anyone ever asked you when they found out that you were a Christian, what kind of Christian you are? Of course, in the denominational world, there are many so-called Christians. And so you could be a Baptist Christian, or a Methodist Christian, or, you know, they'd probably say, well, we're all Christians. And I understand that you have been studying some on denominationalism. And Steve told me that. So, I'm not going to talk about those things. But I want to talk to you about being an excellent Christian. So, let me begin with you tonight in 1 Timothy chapter 2. And we're going to look at verse 9. No, that's not what I want. Well, that is, I'm sorry, but not only am I not seeing it here, I can't find it, and that's terrible. So, what I wanted to start with was to look at the fact that we are called to be His people. And there are a number of passages that we could look at. Walk worthy of the calling with which you have been called, Ephesians chapter 4, and several others. And if you'd ask that question generally, to what are we called as Christians? Well, you would say, perhaps, salvation. And that'd be the right answer. We're called ultimately to be glorified with Christ and to enter into heaven and to spend eternity with Him. So that's true, and yet He calls us to so much more. There's no doubt you understand that there's a here and now. It's not as if, you know, like I think it's one of the country songs, everybody wants to go to heaven, but nobody wants to go down. So there's a period in between, here and now. So in Romans, the 8th chapter, the Apostle Paul tells us here in this passage to what we are, that we are called, and really to what we are called. Beginning in verse 28, And we know that God causes all things to work together for good, for those who are called, for those who love God, to those who are called according to His purpose. For those whom He foreknew, He also predestined to become conformed to the image of His Son, so that He would be the firstborn among many brethren. And these whom He predestined, He also called. And these whom He called, He also justified. And these whom He justified, He also glorified. And so He has called us, and He has called us to become conformed to the image of His Son. That's what He's called us to. And we could spend a great deal of time, I think, pursuing that thought. But that's a call to be transformed. From what we are, that may not presently reflect the character of Christ, though some of you may be Christians for a while and you have been being conformed for a while to the image of His Son. And so you've made some progress with that. And so that you mirror His qualities. And it's a transformation that requires a change in our thinking. So if you look at the 12th chapter, verse 1 says, "Therefore I urge you, brethren, by the mercies of God, to present your bodies as a living, your bodies a living and holy sacrifice, acceptable to God, which is your spiritual service of worship." And so we're going to come back to this chapter later, but what he's telling us is that we have been called for this purpose, to be transformed, conformed to the image of His Son, but that requires transformation, and so to be a living and holy sacrifice, and then do not be conformed to this world, but be transformed by the renewing of your mind, that you may prove what the will of God is, that which is good and acceptable and perfect. So, it's a transformation that requires a change of mind, but not only a change in what we think about. Look over at Colossians, the third chapter. But also how we think about those things. So, it may be that we have thought about things that we should quit thinking about entirely. Just give up things that may have, you know, some attachment to sinful thoughts. Obviously, those things must be left behind. And we're to think upon other things, not on those things. In fact, that's what this passage says. It says, if you have been raised, Colossians 3, verse 1, "Therefore, if you have been raised up with Christ, keep seeking things above, where Christ is seated at the right hand of God. Set your mind on the things above, not on the things that are on the earth." And so we refocus our minds so that we set our minds on the things above, on those things that are of spiritual nature and quality and those things. And then the way in which we think about material things. So it's sometimes a change of focus away from certain things to look upon other things. But then at other times, you know, there's material things that we must think about. You know, you might want to have a place to live, and so you think about having a house. But if you have your mind set upon spiritual things, the way that you approach that may be different than somebody who builds a monument to themselves, for instance, because they're very wealthy, and so they just build a big house in their own honor, or to show that they have money. I was talking to an excavator one time, a fellow at home. We have to dig basements, dig foundations about 8 feet or so in the ground for the frost. And this fellow's an excavator. And when the trend went from just a regular ranch house to these big houses. And you may have one, and I hope I don't offend you, but I hope you do think about it. So when it went to these big houses, I said to him, and here's a fellow whose family, they were millionaires, and he just lived in a regular house. And I said, I said, why? I said, about the time the kids go off to college and marry, that's when they want to build a new house. It's just the two of them, and they're building these big houses. I said, what's going on? And he said, well, it's just a monument to themselves. And that may be. I don't know that, you know, that necessarily is the case. So every time I see a big house, well, they just did that because, you know, maybe they do have a big family. And maybe they just want to have the whole church in. I don't know. In fact, I do know of a situation like that. It fell up in Minneapolis, Minnesota. Elder in the church there, good man. He built a big house so that he could have all the whole church, and that church is over 200 members at the same time in his house. One of the reasons. Well, so it's not necessarily so. It's just what I'm trying to illustrate is that it's not just what we think about, because some things are not wrong in themselves to think about, but how we think about them. So here's what I want to address tonight, and here's how that fits into this. We're called to excellence. We're called to excellence. And part of that, as we finish the lesson tonight, will have to do with excellent thought. But where I want to start is where Jesus talked about this in Matthew chapter 5. And so I'd like for you to look at that with me tonight and talk to you about the fact that we are called to perfection. And I think I need to sort of get to the end of this just briefly, I mean, and then we'll go back and you'll see where we're going with this. So in Matthew chapter 5, when the chapter ends, Jesus said, therefore, you are to be perfect as your heavenly Father is perfect. And that's where this is going. So not perfect in the sense of being without sin, but to a higher level of thinking, excellence, of thought, but then a higher level of action to excel in some things. So excellence in attitude and action. Steve likes words. I've listened a little bit. He's the one who, and he reminded me that he says this. I'm not going to repeat it. Well, I'll just repeat it because he told me this, that words are vehicles upon which thoughts travel. Ever heard that before? That's a great thing because it's true. So you probably know already what a superlative is. Maybe. So it's something that is, at least one way to define it, something that is of the highest quality or degree. And so here's some superlatives. So we have good, better, best. Good, and then the superlative, better, and best above that. Okay? So here are some synonyms, and I like these too. I kind of like that word has that feature of, you know, you can look up synonyms because sometimes it really does emphasize, you know, a particular concept or a word that expresses that concept maybe more fully. And so supreme. And as we look at excellent, supreme, consummate, choice. You know, some of you may want choice meat instead of, especially down here in Texas where you like your beef. First rate, outstanding, unequaled. All right, so look at verse 20. Matthew 5 and verse 20. Jesus uses our word. For I say to you that unless or except your righteousness exceeds that of the scribes and Pharisees, you will not enter the kingdom of heaven. That's a plain statement. So we probably need to look at the scribes and Pharisees a little bit. And so what I'll try to do, and I'll try to do this briefly, you could spend a lot of time looking at this, but to look at what their righteousness was, as Jesus seems to express it here, and what ours should be. So, the Sermon on the Mount. The Pharisees' righteousness and the scribes, unjustly critical of others, established within themselves, in a sense, they made up their own righteousness. I think that's how it might, rather generally be described. And of course, they then saw themselves as the measure of their own righteousness. And they thought that everybody should live like that. And really, they thought themselves superior to others. I thank God that I'm not like this publican. That's how they looked at themselves. Luke 18. So, they would have congratulated themselves over their righteousness. And Jesus says, unless your righteousness exceeds theirs. And these that were listening probably thought, well, how are we going to do that? Because they were looked upon as the measure of righteousness, the standard. And who can surpass that? So he pressed the matter. He spoke of the degree or the measure of God-like character that he would prescribe versus what the Pharisees and scribes were accustomed to teaching and, of course, practicing, apparently. So look at 5 and verse 21. You have heard that the ancients were told, you shall not commit murder, and whoever commits murder shall be liable in the court. Likely you've been over this, so I'm not going to spend a lot of time, but it wasn't just murder. It was a violation of the law of God, but a denigrating attitude, some hateful pronouncement of disdain, and he describes some of that. You empty head or fool. And then in 27, you have heard that it was said, you shall not commit adultery. But I say to you, everyone who looks at a woman to lust after her has committed adultery with her already in his heart. And so, again, he addresses purity of heart, doesn't he? Maintaining purity of heart and eyes that will prevent us from falling into the bed of adultery. It's a higher level of thinking. They would have said, just as long as you don't commit adultery, you don't commit the act. And likewise in 33, you have heard that the ancients were told, you shall not make false vows, but you shall fulfill your vows to the Lord. So, They were in the habit, I think, it seems from the teaching of Jesus, whoever swears by heaven and those things, that they were accustomed to that and in the habit of that, the practice of it, that those vows that they made were very commonly spoken and just as commonly seemingly broken. They would not keep their word, and of course they would find ways around keeping their word. So the word of God's people ought to mean something. That's a way to think about this. I remember when it used to be said, his word is his bond. You might have heard that. And so an oath is unnecessary. Let your yes be yes and your no, no. It's unnecessary when dishonesty does not offend our words of commitment. When we say something and we mean what we say and we intend to keep what we say, then you don't have to swear an oath. It's not necessary. So excellence on the part of Christians look at it one way, is that they're trustworthy. We can look at these things. In fact, we can look at all these things generally and or specifically and then generally. You can extrapolate from these things a lot of different applications. And then 5 in verses 38 to 42, through those verses, there are several responses that we should make toward those who would treat us in certain ways. And not justly. They're treating us unfairly, perhaps, or asking us to do things that we may not want to do. And he says, not only should you do it, but you should do more than that. If somebody asks you to go with them a mile, go with them too. And you can see from those things that there are what Jesus is calling us to do is to respond, but to respond with excellent responses. That which excels what is expected or excels what is really, you might say, required by the mere minimum requirement of the law. And if I can just insert this in here, we tend sometimes maybe to do things like this. So we're required to eat the Lord's Supper on the first day of the week. And so as long as we meet that requirement, we have met the requirement. But what if we are going to be an excellent Christian? Would we go beyond that? Meet for classes and maybe another occasion like a gospel meeting, for instance. So, generosity in the passage would be thought as a superlative action. Somebody wants to borrow from you. Somebody wants to sue you and take your shirt. Let them have your coat also. And he's not saying by that we should just let people run over us. He's saying that you can go further than what the scribes and Pharisees would have done. You can be generous. You can think about the needs of people and respond to them. And the Pharisees were very capable of hate. I know nothing of any expression of love that we can read about them. Do you? Unless they love their own. And then we get there. And that's this. If you love those who love you, what reward do you have? Do not even the tax collectors do the same? They were capable of loving their own. And what Jesus says is, to exceed that righteousness of the scribes and Pharisees, I want you to love with an excellent love like this. Love your enemies. And pray for those who persecute you. That calls us to something excellent. And then finally he says, you're to be perfect as your heavenly Father is perfect. And he's saying that within this context of love. And so he loved us, even though we were enemies. At the right time, Christ died for us. And so it expresses that. To be perfect as your heavenly Father then is perfect. So then in Romans chapter 12, as we said, we'd go back there. The second thing, first our practices, our thoughts and actions exceed that of the scribes and Pharisees. And then excellence of service, a second thing. So we read verses 1 and 2. And so when you buy something, you may grade its quality. Or it may be graded for you. I think recently I was looking for a weed whacker. And the website that I was on actually graded things. Sometimes they grade it by the number of how frequently I think it's or how many of them are sold. And so this is the choice of whoever visits this website. But it'll even say, as we said before, good, better, best, those kind of things. But or we may ascribe our own grade to certain things, products or services. If you were to comment, had to fill out one of those little cards, somebody, at a restaurant, the kind of service that you were provided, you might assign different qualities of service. So fair quality, good quality, excellent quality, poor quality. It seems to me that in many areas, quality has diminished with things. Craftsmanship. I'm always kind of harping on that. I like to build things back to those big houses. A lot of them are just big houses. They don't have much craftsmanship, and some of them don't have much design, really. But the quality of materials, I just love old world craftsmanship. Don't you? I mean, when you see the work that goes into things, some of those old wooden arches and various things that are built, some of the stonework and all that, the quality and craftsmanship and all of that is not only something that you would want if that was being done for you, but it's impressive from the standpoint of how somebody not only has that skill, but they use their skill to create and to craft those things of the highest quality. And it's beautiful, besides. So, services that are provided, sometimes I feel like nobody cares anymore. They'll care. And I know that I can get cynical about the way things are going and all that. We all can. But I really do think that there's fewer quality people anymore. I mean, not among the Lord's people so much, but just good quality people, those you can trust and those that do their work well and all those things. It just seems like some of that's diminishing. Well, that's to raise this question. What about our quality of service as Christians? What about that? So John chapter 12, in John 12 and verse 26, Jesus said of those who would follow him or be his disciples, "If anyone serves me, he must follow me, and where I am, there my servant will be also. If anyone serves me, the Father will honor him." So, this is not just about following in the footsteps of Jesus, that where he is located, we're located, but where he goes, we go, and what he does, we do. Is that not implicit there? My servant will be there too. He'll be right there doing what I do. That's what a disciple is. A disciple is a learner. But then a disciple is the one who then imitates his master or his teacher. And of course, scriptures bear that out. So, if we were to try to grade ourselves, and that's what this is about, that we look at ourselves and try to assess ourselves and assign some sort of grade, what would we assign? What would I assign to myself? It's just as personal for me. So, Galatians chapter 5 and verse 13. The Apostle Paul talked about our service. And he framed it this way. He said, 5 and verse, what I want, verse 13, right? "You are called to freedom, brethren, only do not turn your freedom into an opportunity for the flesh, but through, or by love, serve one another." That's what he calls us to. serving one another. So what is the quality of the service that we offer, we provide, we assist others with? So we follow him as his servants. We love one another, but with a kind of excellent love, a superlative love. Loving our enemies is a different level of love, isn't it? It's not easy. And it's a special kind of way in which we love them because we want them too to be saved. So what is the quality of service that we render to God and then to each other? That's the question. And would we say, or could we say, that it is of first quality? So now I want to look back at Romans chapter 12 and notice some things with you. So beginning in verse 6, Romans chapter 12 and verse 6. And what I'm going to do is I'll read these familiar passages, but I'm going to pick out for you or with you the modifiers of this service that pertain to this service. So we're going to start in chapter 12 and we'll in verse 6. Since we have gifts that differ according to the grace given to us, each of us is to exercise them accordingly. If prophecy, according to the proportion of his faith. If service, in his serving. The original would help us some, but I want to move on to some others. He who teaches us in his teaching, he who exhorts in his exhortation. Now it gets a little easier because it's in the translation. He who gives with liberality. He who leads with diligence. He who shows mercy with cheerfulness. Let love be without hypocrisy. Abhor what is evil. Cling to what is good. Be devoted to one another in brotherly love. Give preference to one another in honor. Not lagging behind in diligence, fervent in spirit, serving the Lord. And so when you read it with that emphasis upon those things that tell us the quality of service or the kind of service that we're to render, then we can ask ourselves that question again. Do we give with cheerfulness? Do we exhort with a sense of urgency, a sense of concern, a sense of true love for one another? So it's easy for us to become satisfied, perhaps, to achieve mediocrity. That may not be the case, but I think it's easy for us to do that. It just kind of reach some level. It's not terrible, but it's not great. And then we just sort of stay there. And usually if you just kind of stay there, you fall backward some. But we have to be careful sometimes about just, you know, feeling adequate to be average. I don't know what average is. I really don't. I have a sense that, you know, when somebody says, well, they don't, you know, when they're referring to somebody else, you talk to them about something and say, well, so-and-so doesn't, you know. And of course, what I think about is this passage over in 2 Corinthians chapter 10 and verse 12. And what Paul said here is that we're not bold to class or to compare ourselves with some of those who commend themselves, but when they measure themselves by themselves and compare themselves with themselves, they're not without understanding. And so that's not the measure, not one another, but Christ, you see. And then Paul's pursuit, we'll not take the time with that. Philippians, the third chapter, and verses 8 to 15, you know that he continued to press on, not that he had arrived, but that he continued to press on. But I do want to refer to this one that he spoke of in 1 Thessalonians chapter 4 and verse 9. And what I would do with this is simply in 1 Thessalonians 4, I hope my voice won't fail me this week. So chapter 4, beginning in verse 9, he says, "Now as to the love of the brethren." So just as an example, and let me say to you, I already sense that you love one another. I really do. I'm not saying that because I want to patronize you or something. I really do have a sense of that. I had a sense of it before. Friends with Rod Himes, and he certainly spoke very highly of you in the time that I visited before. But he says, "You have no need for anyone to write to you. You yourselves are taught by God to love one another." And so you love one another, I'm sure. "For indeed you do practice it toward all the brethren who are in all Macedonia. But we urge you, brethren, to excel still more." And so what Paul was saying is, you love the brethren. But he urged them, just excel in that. And we can always do that with all kinds of things. And so, quickly, as our time draws near to that hour, I want to talk to you just briefly about excellence of speech. And so here's what I want to address, and I'll try to do it briefly. Language and speech, again, I said it before, and I don't think I'm entirely cynical when I say all these things, but it's degraded over time. And I'm not one that thinks that we ought to just speak formally all the time. That we just, you know, that we have to, but we've lost some, I think, when it comes to just language and speech. And I talk to my kids about that all the time. Formal speech and writing, especially, has been replaced with what we do when we text. You know, we abbreviate everything and all that, and colloquial expression. And I really can't take issue with a lot of that stuff. It's just a matter of preference for me. But because I know language evolves, you know, there are all kinds of things that, you know, we could talk about there. But it becomes a problem when slang and euphemistic speech becomes profane and maybe just vulgar. That is, of the earth, profane and unholy speech. And sometimes just vulgarity. So what the Apostle Paul wrote in Ephesians chapter 4 and verse 29, "Let no unwholesome or rotten word proceed from your mouth, but only such a word as is good for edification, according to the need of the moment, so that it will give grace to those who hear." Real quickly, I was with Randy Lacey, fell in Pleasant Grove Church, and he's been there his whole life. And his mother is getting old, and he's caring for her, and so he brings her. And he'll not get out for a long while she talks with her beloved sisters there, her brethren. And Randy said, "If we're going to give, an account for every word that we speak, my mom's going to be there a long time." So let that maybe just be to do this, that we are going to give an account for the words that we speak. And I enjoy conversation. But not only should we not speak with rotten words, but we should think about edifying one another. Words that would edify, maybe a little more often. Excel in those kinds of things. Chapter 5 and verse 5. no, four. For this reason, there must be no filthiness or silly talk or coarse jesting, which is not fitting, but rather giving of thanks. And so do you see the other side of it? Not just don't say this, but give thanks. A little more expression of thanks that exalts and honors and glorifies God. So in the other direction. So character is so often reflected through our speech, content, the language, those things. And Jesus said so, of course, out of the mouth. We speak what fills the heart. And so when I hear, and sometimes it's, you know, euphemistic cussing, I call it, you know, pardon my French kind of things that I hear when somebody finds out that I'm, you know, a preacher or Christian, they'll say that. You've heard it. But I sometimes want to cry out in the words of Jesus, and maybe I'm, you know, going too far with this, but I just want to say sometimes, Father, forgive them, for they know not what they say. So we need to be careful, I think, about what we say, obviously, but to know what we say. We may not know what we're saying with some of those things. And I've, you know, developed a list of things that I know, and I know some of you probably know that same list. But so I think that with this, that excellence of speech among Christians will sound as if it's a megaphone of moral excellence that shouts into the ears of a profane and worldly people. I think people notice that. And sometimes they notice that we're different because of things that we do. And sometimes that's speech, the content of our words, and the very words themselves that express a higher level of thought and godliness. So, surely you'll agree that excellence should be the pursuit of every Christian. And is it our earnest goal would be a good question for us to ask. And then whatever we're doing, I keep hearing the echo of Paul's words in my ears, and that is, excel still more. And so that's the mountain we continue to climb. But these are things not only recommended, expressly commanded in places, but they touch upon the very endowments of human potential that God has put within our trust. So we're His people, made in His image, and we're to reflect His glory. And there are a lot of different ways that we can be thinking about that. This is just one of them. And so as we live our lives as an excellent people, we're going to be noticed, and it's not for our sake, but for His glory, because in this, as we live, and we'll talk about this later in the week, the Lord willing, we keep our behavior excellent among the Gentiles, so that in the thing in which they slander us as evildoers, they may, on account of our good deeds and perhaps our words, glorify God in the day of visitation. So that's where I'll leave it with you tonight. And I appreciate your kind attention to these things. I hope that it'll be worth your while to have listened and to heard these things tonight. So we'll sing a song of encouragement for those who are here and would respond. Let the brethren know here, and they'll assist you in obeying the gospel if that's your need.